You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Yesterday, the city of Los Angeles City Council voted unanimously to say corporations are not people, money is not speech, and we encourage our elected representatives to pass a constitutional amendment to strip corporations of those rights. Corporations, Walmart, for example, on various occasions, hog farms, waste disposal plants, they've claimed 14th Amendment rights to say we're being discriminated against because we're a person. If the community says no, the tobacco companies, asbestos companies have used 4th and 5th Amendment protection and self-incrimination rights to keep their crimes from us. And, of course, the First Amendment right of free speech that is right at the core of Citizens United and whatnot. So step by step, and one of those steps has been taken by Congressman Keith Ellison, who's on the line with us, ellison.house.gov, of course, his website, the congressman from the 5th District of Minnesota. Congressman, welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program.
Always good to be on with you, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. It is great to have you with us. Congressman, you are an attorney.
Yep.
And so I'm sure you're familiar with the difference between a natural person and an artificial person, going all the way back to the 6th century in British common law.
Absolutely. I have a passing familiarity. See, mostly natural persons, they love, they sometimes hate, they have a body that you can jail, they have a soul that you can save. Those are the clues you
right.
can go by.
Yeah, there you go. And artificial persons are basically governments
right.
and corporations yeah. and churches.
Yep.
And so you have proposed an amendment that would do what?
Four things. And one, declare that corporations are not people. Two, state that we have a compelling state interest, a compelling public interest to prevent corruption among elected officials. Mm-hmm. Three, that the ability reinstates Congress's ability, along with states, to regulate funds used for political activity by for-profit corporations and similar entities. And then the last one, four, makes clear that no part of the amendment abridges the freedom of the press. So, one, corporations are people. Two, we have a compelling public interest in making sure we don't have corrupt public officials who could be corrupted by money, mm-hmm. corporations. Three, Congress can regulate these people. And four, this does not affect freedom of the press.
Yeah. And in fact, reading from your amendment here, because of the compelling public interest in preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption among elected officials, and because corporations and other business organizations are not natural persons or citizens, I got to say, God bless you for that, sir, because there are, as you, I'm sure you know, I'm sure you've been lobbied on this, there are a number of groups, organizations, and people, some of them very well intentioned, and some of them, I think, maybe working on the other side,
mm-hmm.
Who are saying, oh, we don't need to deal with this corporate personhood issue. What we really just need to do is get the money out of politics. And I'm saying, you know, yeah, getting money out of politics.
The heart of the issue.
Yeah, getting money out of politics is nice, but let's cut this, let's pull this weed out by the roots.
Yeah, let's rip it out and say that, you know, first of all, the history on corporate personhood is actually not very old. I mean, these people basically gain their personhood status on the backs of newly freed slaves.
Yeah.
They basically wedged their way in on the 14th Amendment when they got the Supreme Court, which was still sort of a, you know, sort of an antebellum Supreme Court, to sort of to say that they're persons.
Yeah.
To recognize them as having the rights thereof. You know, there was a time when a corporate charter was a big deal. It had to be for the public interest. It had a very limited duration. And if they didn't serve that public interest, they had their corporate charter yanked.
Yeah, I wrote the first book on this, and it's Unequal Protection. And I was amazed, you know, because I wanted to do research based on original sources. You know, everybody does. It's easy to write a book based on other people's books,
mm-hmm.
but I was going to do all original sources. And so I went down in Vermont.
Back, this was in 1999. I went into the Supreme Court building, which is like, you know, older than our country. Vermont was a nation before it joined the rest of the union.
Yep.
And said to to Mr. Donovan, Paul Donovan, the librarian, and he's also an attorney. I said, you know, I'd like to see that 1886 case where corporations became people. And he said, oh, you mean Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad? He pulls it out, gives it to me. I flipped through it, and I read the case. You know, it's like 16 pages long. Yeah. Read it all the way through, and I said, I can't find anything in here where it says corporations are people. And he was like, well, it's got to be in there. I learned that in law school. And so he's flipping around, and he says, well, let's look at the headnote.
Right.
And so we look at the headnote, and here's the headnote. It says corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection. And I'm like, where'd that, you know, and he's like, where'd that come from? And that's, you know, I got that into my book, that the court actually never ruled that corporations
right.
are people. That the clerk of the court wrote that, and he was a railroad president before he was the clerk of the court.
And they totally shoehorned their way into the position they have now from a legal standpoint.
Yeah.
And now, you know, talk about like Frankenstein, you know, this is a monster we can't control, you know.
Yeah.
This thing was designed, originally intended to be something that would serve the public interest, and now its only dedication is to serve its own selfish private interest and that of the shareholder. And to the detriment or disregard of the public interest.
Right. Well, and arguably since the I think it was the 30s, Dodge v. Ford in the Michigan Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
that's been pretty much kind of accepted the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So Congressman Ellison, this is a House resolution, joint resolution. I don't see a number on it here.
Should be one there. Let me. Okay, we don't have a number yet. Well, I'll get you one as soon as we can.
Okay, well, that's fine.
But
people
we did drop it, and it's in, and we should have a number real quick.
Cool. So people can call, and they can call their members of Congress and just say, hey, sign on with Keith Ellison on this
that's
thing about corporate personhood.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep. Okay.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, this I was obviously in aware of this whole mess well before Citizens United. When I was in the Minnesota State Legislature, you know, of course, you know, I got exposed to your work. But then also there's a state legislator in Minnesota named Bill Hilty who turned me on to the idea of, you know, the problem of corporate personhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a long-term and enduring problem that you kind of were, you know, kind of been heralding for many years. But now it has just gotten to the point where it's just really absurd. I mean,
yeah.
The corporate entity is like the most powerful entity in the world we live in, and it's surpassed
well,
the power of the state.
You know, in Greece and in Italy, they have taken down the elected prime ministers and replaced them with appointed banksters.
Oh, my goodness. See, you know you got problems then.
Yeah. And you know, in Michigan, they did the same, you know, Governor Snyder did the same thing with the city of Benton Harbor.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that is shocking, is it not? I mean, in Benton Harbor, they have said that, you know, they have the authority to enforce the law. They are going to usurp people's rights, and let me tell you, this is a foreshadowing of things to come unless we get wise right now and do something about this corporate personhood problem.
Yeah.
So it's time to move a constitutional amendment. I believe that this Occupy movement, which is a great thing in my view, has the power to really raise this issue and to make, you know, politicians do the right thing.
Yep.
I believe that. But it's really, we've really got to raise the roof on it, because without a massive movement, you know, these guys are just going to keep on rolling.
Right. So, you know, in essence, what we're trying to do is put the word natural before the word person in the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
And this is a way to do it. And the way for all of our listeners and all of our viewers to participate is to call their member of the House of Representatives. Everybody has one, and they're two senators, and say, get on board with Keith Ellison's proposal or his amendment to the Constitution to strip corporations of their personhood rights.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, we got it. We're on it. Congressman Keith Ellison, ellison.house.gov for all the information. Thank you for the great work you're doing, sir, and thank you for being on our program today.
Keep it up.
You betcha. Great to see you. Great to have you with us. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up, will firefighting soon only be available to the top 1%? Seriously.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
From their toes?
Yuletide squirrels.
Squirrels?
Fresh filleted by the choir. They poked hot skewers through their
knows.
Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. Some pepper and a garlic clove help to make them season right. Tiny rats with a crisp golden cold will really hit the spot tonight.
Yeah, there you go. Happy holidays. It's time. It's time for our favorite Christmas carols. Oh, I'm sorry. I realize that's horrible, and that's probably why it's one of my favorites. But here's a variation on it. It's the perfect segue for this story. And the reason why it, you know, we can do it with some lightheartedness, although having somebody's house burned down is never a lighthearted thing. You lose all your pictures, you lose all your papers, you lose everything. But at least nobody's life was lost. Nobody's family pet got burned up. But for the second time in a little over a year in Tennessee, firefighters have arrived at the scene of a house fire and stood and watched as the house burned down. Vicki Bell's house caught on fire. I believe it was a mobile home, actually. She dialed 911. Police showed up. The fire department showed up. They looked up in their index, in their database, to see if she had paid the $75 annual pay-for-spray fee to the county. She had not, and so they let her house burn down, her home burn down. The mayor of the city, a guy by the name of David Crocker, he says, "This is just fine. This is the way it is." He says, "There's no way to go to every fire and keep up the manpower, the equipment, and just the funding for the fire department." Why not simply roll that $75 fee into what's called taxes? Oh, well, because with a progressive taxation system, that would mean that rich people would pay a little more than $75 and poor people would pay a little less than $75. Well, has it occurred to you, Mayor, that the rich people might have bigger houses that'll be harder to put the fires out and more expensive to take care of, and the poor people may have smaller? It's like, this is what President Obama was talking about yesterday in his speech. President Obama yesterday, this I believe was the first real speech of his presidential campaign. And in it, he began channeling Teddy Roosevelt. You know, Franklin Roosevelt's the guy who got us out of the Great Depression in the 1930s and who fought World War II. He died after we defeated Hitler, but before we defeated Tojo. Truman, then his vice president, became president, dropped the bomb on Japan, ended the war. You know, that was the end of that, and then ran for reelection himself and won. But the first Roosevelt was Teddy. And Teddy Roosevelt was the vice president of McKinley, who ran for president in the election of 1900 and won. And in 1901, after McKinley was shot by a crazy man, an assassin who's been characterized as a schizophrenic or a psychopath, and McKinley died, Teddy Roosevelt, who up to that point had just been this kind of rough rider, you know, military guy, big game hunter, Republican, became president. And he started busting up big companies. They called him the Trust Buster. In fact, it was so popular that after he left the presidency and Taft followed him, Taft kept on doing it. I mean, the Republicans back then were progressives, at least some of them, a large sum of them. And so stealing a page from Newt Gingrich and all these others, you know, I mean, all these Republicans, they love to talk about Teddy Roosevelt, but none of them will embrace his policies. President Obama did yesterday. He started out by talking about how important this is, this moment for the middle class. Clip one, Jacob.
This is a make or break moment for the middle class, for all those who are fighting to get into the middle class. And the middle class has shrunk. The child born today will only have a 1 in 3 chance of making it to the middle class. If we want a strong middle class, incomes that lift people into the middle class offer middle class security. We simply cannot return to this brand of you're on your own economics if we're serious about rebuilding the middle class in this country.
Yeah, you're on your own. That should be the slogan of the Republican Party, and I think that President Obama just stenciled it across their foreheads. Clip number three is where I think this is the first time that any president since Ronald Reagan promoted trickle-down economics, and I was out there saying, oh yeah, that'll just produce a nation of peons. This is the first president, who has come out and called out trickle-down economics, so this doesn't work. Clip three.
Now, just as there was in Teddy Roosevelt's time, there is a certain crowd in Washington who for the last few decades have said, let's respond to this economic challenge with the same old tune. The market will take care of everything, they tell us. If we just cut more regulations and cut more taxes, especially for the wealthy, our economy will grow stronger. Sure, they say, there will be winners and losers, but if the winners do really well, then jobs and prosperity will eventually trickle down to everybody else. And, they argue, even if prosperity doesn't trickle down, well, that's the price of liberty. Now, it's a simple theory. And we have to admit, it's one that speaks to our rugged individualism and our healthy skepticism of too much government. That's in America's DNA. And that theory fits well on a bumper sticker. But here's the problem. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It never has.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Whether you're talking about saving homes on fire or bodies on fire, metaphorically, people's health care, or, homelessness, trickle-down economics doesn't work.
You don't care for me.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Our conservative alert for the day. This is a fascinating little insight into the mind of Michelle Bachmann, who claims to be so deeply compassionate, particularly toward children. She foster parented so many of them. A little cottage industry she ran there for years and years. And here's what she had to say last night when Bill O'Reilly said, do you really want to be putting parents in buses in front of their crying children, separating the children from their parents, throwing them into the foster care system, et cetera, while their parents are being deported? Here's the clip.
Children that are here now are going to be an enormous problem to deal with because there are a lot of people here who have been here for a lot of years, and if you're going to start dragging them out of here, it's going to be very, very difficult to do that.
But remember, they broke the law to get in here.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying on a human basis. I don't think theory is one thing. Dragging people out, putting them on a bus with their children's crying.
It can be done. That's the thing. It can be done.
It can be done. You could. To hell with human beings. It's about the principles. It's just like the little kid who came up to her a couple of days ago at the book signing. You know, that pointed out she's doing book signing. This is a make money tour. For Michelle Bachmann, it cost her $11 million to get elected. As I pointed out the other day, she was confronted by a little boy whose mother was gay, and he said, "My mom is gay, and she doesn't need fixing." And Michelle Bachmann reacted as if somebody had stuck a cobra in her face. She just jerked back with a horrified look on her face and got out of the way. Didn't say a word. Not thank you for coming by, little Timmy, or wasn't that sweet, or, yes, your mommy's a human being too. No, it's just the humanity, right? Or frankly, the lack of humanity. So, President Obama yesterday gave this speech, and he was laying out, first of all, he did his Teddy Roosevelt part about how trickle-down economics has never worked. Never worked then, doesn't work now, doesn't happen. And then he points out in clip number five here that Teddy Roosevelt This is the older Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt from the first decade of the 20th century. Franklin Roosevelt from the third and fourth decades of the 20th century. And they're distantly related, third cousins, but they didn't really know each other. The first Republican Roosevelt understood that markets can work only when there's rules. You know, I keep getting these cons on. In fact, Stephen Moore is going to be on the program later. It'll be interesting to discuss this with him, the editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal, saying, oh, we need free markets, no rules. And I keep saying, isn't that like a football game without referees? And, you know, we did away with Glass-Steagall, and look what happened. The banks crashed. So here's Obama's response to that.
But Roosevelt also knew that the free market has never been a free license to take whatever you can from whomever you can. He understood that the free market only works when there are rules of the road that ensure competition is fair and open and honest.
Yeah, there you go. Pretty straightforward. And then he went from that to the issue that Teddy Roosevelt also talked about in his speech, which we've played on the show a number of times. I'm not going to ask Jacob to dig it out again because it's so hard to hear. It's really scratchy. It's one of the really early Edison recordings where he said, we stand for a fair deal. A living wage. He said, we stand for a living wage. A living wage is enough that you can raise your family, you can enough to pay for, you know, industrial occupations, and enough to raise your family, put your children through school, pay for medical care, have time for a vacation, and have reasonable savings for old age. That was Teddy Roosevelt's square deal. And it was basically the articulation of the American dream. Franklin Roosevelt, 30 years later, turned that into the American dream. And it stood until Ronald Reagan came along and said, no. The American dream is to become a bankster, hit the jackpot, become a millionaire, get a yacht, you know, and like that. But inequality, we have become one. The United States, Singapore, and the United Kingdom are the most unequal societies among the developed world. I mean, you know, you could look at Zimbabwe, but among the developed world, among the 34 OECD countries, we are these three. We are among the most unequal. Our rich are richer than anybody else's, and our poor are poorer. And the spread between the two is greater. And what that does is it means that you have higher levels of mental illness. In fact, the BBC did a report where they said that probably if the United States had the equality levels, the inequality levels, not of the U.S., but instead of a country like Denmark, we would have half the level of mental illness. We would dramatically decrease drug addiction, both prescription and illegal. We would radically drop, you know, crime would radically drop. People's lack of trust in each other, government, and in society would go from a negative to a positive. Child abuse would be on the decline. Spousal abuse would be on the decline. Homicide rates could drop in half. Imprisonment rates. We have more people in prison in the United States, both numerically and as a percentage of our population, than any other country on earth. That would decline if we simply diminished inequality. And the president last night, and this is amazing. Now, you know, here simple response to all this is, you know, the rhetoric is great. Let's see the legislation. But nonetheless, rhetoric first, right? This is his response. This is what this clip I'm going to play for you in just a second proves, is that 12 weeks into its existence, the Occupy Wall Street movement has changed the political dialogue, has changed the course of the United States. When the president of the United States is talking about inequality in the United States, here it is, clip 6.
This kind of gaping inequality gives lie to the promise that's at the very heart of America, that this is a place where you can make it if you try.
Inequality, in other words, is killing the American dream. And it's killing Americans. You know, Ricky Santorum this morning came out and said, We don't need food stamps. Look at how many fat poor people there are. I'm not making this up. Rick Santorum said that because we have an obesity epidemic in the United States, we can do away with food stamps. Let's look like Biafra, right? Let's look like Ethiopia in a famine. When people start getting stick thin, then you can roll out the food stamps. Well, the fact of the matter is that the more unequal a country is, the more obesity it has. The less unequal a country is, the less obesity it has. You could see obesity as a symptom of a cultural and societal disorder. Some people shoot drugs. Some people beat each other up. Some people obsessively eat. These are all responses to a society that doesn't work, to living in terror that you won't be able to pay your rent, that you're going to lose your job, that if you get sick, you're going to be busted and broken and everything's gone. We are also the only nation in the world, or at least in the developed world, where in order to go to college, we had a guy call into the program last week. You might not have heard this. I mean, you know, people who listen all 3 hours, I'm certain you did, but you know, some people tune in, tune out as they're driving to work or whatever, and are going to lunch or breakfast or whatever, dinner, whatever it may be. And we had a guy call into the program who was an Indian, as in from the country India, here in the United States. And I was talking about education in India. He said he went to one of the state universities in India to get his undergraduate degree, his BS, his bachelor's degree in science. Good school. State school, you know, like the land-grant colleges that Abraham Lincoln founded, like Michigan State University kind of stuff, you know, the state schools, University of Georgia, the land-grant colleges. He said he went to one of those in India. His tuition was $1 a year. $1 a year. And yet in America, we're graduating kids with $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $70,000, $80,000 debts. And now they can't find jobs. This is insane. Clip number 7.
In this economy, a higher education is the surest route to the middle class. The unemployment rate for Americans with a college degree or more is about half the national average. And their incomes are twice as high as those who don't have a high school diploma. Which means we shouldn't be laying off good teachers right now. We should be hiring them. We shouldn't be expecting less of our schools. We should be demanding more. We shouldn't be making it harder to afford college. We should be a country where everyone has a chance to go and doesn't rack up $100,000 of debt just because they went.
Keep in mind, Thomas Jefferson, Louise and I went to Monticello a few weekends ago. On his tombstone, it doesn't say President of the United States, it says founder of the University of Virginia, the nation's first free college. We need to get back to the values of Thomas Jefferson that Ronald Reagan stopped.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yes, Ronald Reagan stopped. The University of California used to be free until Reagan became governor.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. The guy behind you won't leave you alone.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Well, the response to President Obama's call for greater equality in our society and pointing out that trickle-down economics doesn't work. From Senator John McCain, clip 11 here, Jacob, was, these multinational corporations that do business all over the world and send our jobs overseas, generate enormous profits doing so. They keep those profits overseas so they don't have to pay U.S. income tax. They park them in, you know, the Cayman Islands or their tax havens. And they're sitting on $1 trillion out there. And if they brought it back, they'd have to pay 35% income tax. So why don't we just give it to them at a lower tax rate? After all, they're rich corporations. This is insanity, but this is what John McCain had to say.
We need to come to an agreement on things like repatriation of the $1.5 trillion that's sitting overseas. We could give them a lower tax rate, a much lower tax rate, to bring that money home and create jobs. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, now this is just plain old flat-out flaming nuts. Mike in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I was over in Kansas yesterday for President Obama's speech. I didn't see it, but when I stopped last night, I'm a truck driver.
Uh-huh.
When I stopped last night, I was watching the local news, and they were interviewing people coming out of the speech. And I heard at least two people say, you know, in the past I voted Republican, but in the next election I'm going to vote Democrat.
Wow.
I really believe in this next election the Republicans are going to be shown the door. I think it's going to be a landslide. I think they're going to lose seats in Congress. I think they're going to lose seats in the Senate. People are starting to realize that the Republicans only care about the top 1%.
Yep.
They don't care about the people that are the average working guy out here.
Yeah, Americans are starting to wake up to this. It's slow, and I think that, you know, for example, there's these people, the ditto heads who listen to Rush Limbaugh, who don't realize that the guy has paid $400 million. They listen to Sean Hannity. They don't realize he makes $200 million. They listen to Glenn Beck. They don't realize last year he made $35 million. These guys, you know, talk about the 1%. Talk about the spokespeople. Talk about the shills for the 1%. Yeah,
Mike, I
hope and pray that you are right. And if the Democrats play this right, you will be right. And if they don't, if they blow it, it's going to be on their, you know, what can you say?
If I was lucky enough to make $15 or $18 or $20 million a year, and the government sent me a letter saying, look, we have no problem with you making $20 million a year, but to make that $20 million, you're going to need to spend an extra $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 in taxes. You know what I'd say? When you take a check.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, why are these people so? Do they realize that someday they're going to die and they can't take that money with them?
Yeah,
I mean,
no, thanks a lot, Mike. No, it's a form of mental illness. It's called obsessive compulsive disorder, and the object of their obsession is money. Mark in Encino, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I'm a lawyer, and the idea that lawyers before the Supreme Court would cite a headnote as authority for anything, such as corporate personhood, is astounding to me. Since law school, we were taught that headnotes are not the law. Only what the court says in opinion is the law.
Right. In fact, there was a case in 1909, as I recall, 1909, maybe it was 1919, that specifically where the court was asked to rule on whether headnotes had any legal standing at all, even an advisory, and the court explicitly ruled that they do not.
Absolutely not, for the reason you stated. They're written by clerks and or researchers to summarize, and I was excoriated as a law clerk by an associate attorney for trying to do that because I was behind. I mean, it's just astounding that somebody in the opposition arguing the opposition of that issue before the Supreme Court wouldn't say, no, Your Honors, they can't cite a headnote for this proposition, and it's not the language of the court.
Want to hear an amazing story about that, Mark? In the 1980s, I think it was 86, was the First National Bank versus Bilotti case, where the First National Bank, Massachusetts used to have a law saying corporations couldn't participate in politics unless it had to do with their business. And the First National Bank of Boston was politicking about something that didn't have to do with their business. And so I think his name was Frank Bilotti, the attorney general, sued them. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. That's First National Bank versus Bilotti in the 1980s. And in that case, the Supreme Court, I believe it was a 5-4 decision. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can participate in, political dialogues that are outside of the realm of their own business. And Rehnquist was one of the dissenters. And in his dissent, Rehnquist wrote, and I encourage you to look up this dissent, it'll blow your mind. Rehnquist wrote back in, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, but this is pretty close. Back in 1886, in the case of Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, this court, without the benefit of public debate or discussion, ruled that corporations are entitled to the rights of natural persons under the 14th Amendment. I believe, Rehnquist went on to say, that that case was wrongly decided and we should not be using it as precedent for this case, Boston versus Bilotti. First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti. Rehnquist didn't even know that it was only in the headnote. And so when the Caskey case came up in 2002, where Mark Caskey was suing suing Nike for basically lying in letters to the editor around the country saying that they had ended their sweatshop practices, one of the main goals of the friend of the court brief, the amicus brief that was being put together by the attorneys for Caskey, was to say to Rehnquist, who was at that time Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you ought to go back and read the, you know, Santa Clara County, because not only were you right in First National Bank versus Bilotti, but you were righter than you even think. The court granted cert. They agreed to hear the case of Caskey versus Nike. They took our oral arguments. They took the letters to the, you know, friends of the court letters, the amicus briefs. Over 100 of them from the largest corporations in America, including the New York Times Corporation, Washington Post, all of these saying corporations are persons, they should have rights of personhood. And this one from Mark Caskey that basically said to Rehnquist, go back and read Santa Clara County. When that friend of the court brief hit the Supreme Court, a couple of days later, all of a sudden, Rehnquist, the Chief Justice, and the rest of the court said, oops, and they issued a one-sentence opinion in that case saying cert was granted inappropriately, or it was a different word than inappropriately, but granted, you know, it shouldn't have been granted, basically. In other words, we're not going to hear the case, we're not going to talk about the case, we're going to pretend it never happened. It's mind-boggling, because they realized the whole thing was based on a lie. Mark, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So in the last hour, we started out with Congressman Keith Ellison, who most often is described as the only Muslim in Congress. But, you know, there's so much more to him than that. The guy is an attorney, and he has, as an attorney, he understands the difference between a natural person and an artificial person. That is, a natural person is like you and me. We can breathe, we eat, we live, we die, we love, we hate, we fill in the blanks, actually. You know, all that stuff. An artificial person is a government, a corporation, or a church. And that's it. So he has proposed a constitutional amendment that explicitly says corporations are not natural persons. Now, you know, I could quibble with him about the language of it. I think it's going to get fine-tuned over time. I don't think his language is exactly perfect, but boy, is it a hell of a lot better than nothing. In fact, it's a lot better than most of the things that I've seen. Yesterday, the Los Angeles City Council, you'll recall a couple of days ago, we had Caitlin Belknap is her last name, on this program, Caitlin and David Cobb and those folks who run movetoamend.org was on the program talking about how the City Council of Los Angeles was going to have this vote yesterday. And please show up. You know, we want to pack the room. It was a unanimous vote. Los Angeles is now, this is, you know, I know in terms of media markets, radio markets, because that's, you know, the rankings that I see. Los Angeles is the second largest radio market in the United States. And, you know, we are live in Los Angeles every day on KTLK and you know, other vehicles as well. But Los Angeles is, it's a big deal. It's a big city. And here, the second, arguably the second largest, I don't know if it's actually the second largest radio, or the, excuse me, city in the United States. I just know it's the second largest media market. But here you have the, you know, one of the largest cities in the United States. The city council officially, on record, recommending to the congressional delegation of that state to pass a constitutional amendment to the Constitution of the United States that says that corporations are not people and that money is not speech. And as I said, in the last hour, Congressman Keith Ellison came on, said he's saying the same thing. He has introduced legislation to that effect, in fact, a specific amendment to that effect, into the House of Representatives. You can contact your member of Congress and tell them, hey, support what Congressman Ellison is doing. I guarantee it's going to be one of several. And some of them are going to try and water this down And they're going to say, oh, we shouldn't go after corporate personhood. The idea that corporations are persons, after all, they should have their 14th Amendment rights so that Walmart can say, oh, you have to let us into your community because not to do so would be to discriminate against us. Or the tobacco and asbestos companies, you know, the Fourth Amendment rights to privacy, Fifth Amendment rights to not incriminate themselves. They have to be able to cover up their crimes. Halliburton just destroyed all that evidence that they might have been the ones responsible for murdering 11 men in the BP Gulf explosion disaster, oil spill thing. And who at Halliburton is going to jail? As far as I can tell, nobody. So anyway, the day that I opened the microphone on this program 9 years ago, not like to this day, but it's been 9 years we've been doing it. We're in the ninth year of this show. I have been talking about this. I mean, that was the year after my book, Unequal Protection, came out about corporate personhood. About the, you know, and I've been saying literally since the first day of this show, we made the decision really early on. We were not going to do politics as sport. Oh, it's my team, your team. You know, it's who's above, who's below, who's, you know, all that kind of stuff that you see in the mainstream media. That instead we were going to actually talk about real issues on this program and try to educate people, wake people up, and bring democracy back to America. And step one in doing that is making people aware of the fact that corporations are not persons and money is not speech, but one of the three branches of government has said so, and they did so with no constitutional authority, and they did so against the wishes of both Congress and the president, and various congresses and presidents, all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. And that one agency is the Supreme Court. And I pointed out this, where this will go, this domination by corporations, will be an out-of-balance system where eventually you will see the beginnings of the death of democracy. And people 9 years ago were going, eh. Well, actually, it was the early years of the Bush administration. They were going, yeah. Looks like it, doesn't it? But, you know, corporate person, what the hell's that? Do you think that the Italians, any of the modern Italians, now, you know, I'm not talking about the people who were alive in the 1930s when Mussolini came to power. There's very few of them left. But people who were born post-World War II, do you think that those Italians, who have always seen their country as a small-d democratic state, do you think that they thought in their wildest dreams that they would ever see the day come when their elected prime minister was replaced by an appointed bankster? Do you think that the Greeks, the cradle of democracy, 3,000 years ago, democracy's first experiment took place in Athens? Do you think that the Greeks, in their wildest dreams, ever thought that they would see the day when their prime minister, their elected prime minister, would call for a referendum, for a vote by all the people in the country about whether or not they should bail out the banksters, and simply because he called for democracy, he would be replaced by an appointed, unelected bankster? And now the plans that Merkel and Sarkozy are pushing would basically say, if they can get, if Angela Merkel can get enough of the EU nations to sign on to these treaty changes, and she's saying, oh, this may take 5 years, but we'd like to do it really quickly. What these changes will say is that any nation in the European Union can have their elected government replaced by banksters and bureaucrats if the EU decides that they're not running their country the way that it should be run. Well, you say, well, that's Europe. You know, I mean, the Italians, they've done crazy stuff. Fascism was a word that was invented by Mussolini, or at least promoted by him, invented by Giovanni Gentile in his administration. Never happened in the United States, right? You ever heard of Benton Harbor, Michigan? Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder going into the city of Benton Harbor saying, you know, your elected city council, they're out. We are replacing them with one of my buddies, a guy named Joseph Harris. We're going to pay him $100,000 a year or more, and he's going to run your city, and he's not elected, and you got no say in what the decisions he makes. Oh, and we're going to do the same thing in Detroit with one of the school districts. Maybe we'll do it with the city. You think democracy isn't at risk here in the United States right now? And in our allied countries in Europe? And what's driving it? It's the banksters. And what gave them that power? The idea that corporations are persons and money is speech, so they can seize our political process.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we have to unroll that, we have to undo that, and we have to do it now.
Yeah, these justices respect whatever the founders had in mind, except the part about keeping corporations very much in line. They used to be limited partnerships with a very limited reach, but now, by God, they're people with tender feelings and free speech. Thank God for the Supreme Court, the modest and high-minded sort, never would rule us from the bench, hit us with a monkey wrench, except when it comes to appointing a president for a democratic nation. We're handing elections over to monster corporations.
Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Baum in Portland, it says you disagree with me, so you go first. What's up?
You know, you make several good points throughout your commentary, but I think the thing that you fail to really recognize in the United States when you say that, you know, I listened to Obama talk about how in America there's no equality and nobody gets a...
No, he didn't say that.
Well, let me ask you, were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth?
No.
Neither was I. Was Obama born with a silver spoon in his mouth?
No.
So how am I able to work right now, have two kids, have a wife, have a family, support them, have a dog, drive around in my SUV to do my work? How am I able to do it, but yet nobody else has a chance?
Let me ask you, if Albert Einstein had been born in a slum in Birmingham, Alabama, back in 1890, do you think he would have been the Albert Einstein that we know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because he's intelligent. He would have found a way to make what he had to do true. And people who are willing to work in this country have jobs.
I respectfully disagree. What we have seen in the United States is that I don't know your age, but I can tell you what I did when I was young, what Louise and I did, we've started 7 businesses in our lives. What we did because we didn't have to worry about what would happen if we got sick. Health insurance was cheap. You know, the first business I started, we were paying $35 a month for Blue Cross Blue Shield for ourselves and all of our employees. We had a business where we provided health care and daycare to all of our... In fact, we created a daycare center just for our employees because we could do that. It was the environment was completely different than it is today. The inequality in the United States has gotten so extreme. I strongly encourage you, if you really care about this issue and you're not just calling because, you know, you're some GOP shill with some talking points, but if you really care about this issue, Baum, I strongly encourage you to go to equalitytrust.org.uk, where you can find the statistics. Kate Pickett Richard Wilkinson wrote this book called The Spirit Level, and they look state by state in the United States, and then they compare the United States against the 34 OECD nations, and what you find is that nation after nation after nation, when inequality increases, mental illness goes up, drug abuse goes up, obesity goes up, child abuse goes up, spousal abuse goes up, homicide goes up, petty crime goes up, imprisonment goes up. And when inequality decreases, all those social ills go down and trust in society goes up. Participation in democracy goes up. Education goes up. There is an absolute linear relationship between inequality and that the list of social ills and social goods that I just laid out for you. And those are the things that provide the foundation on which you can build your business and I can build my business. And I can tell you right now, we may be the lucky ones, Baum, but there are a whole bunch of people out there right now who are working in jobs where they are they may have a brilliant idea. They might be the next Steve Jobs. They might be the next Albert Einstein. But if they're afraid to lose their job because they will not have health insurance. They're afraid to lose their job because they can't find another one. They're afraid to leave their job because they've got a mask because their home is underwater. You got 1 in 5 people in America who can't find a job, and you've got 1 in 4 kids in America living in poverty. Those are not the conditions under which you will have a vibrant and entrepreneurial America, and that's why we don't anymore. How many you walk into the local mall, you walk into the local downtown, how many local businesses do you think you're going to see? What percentage do you think you're going to see?
You know, I don't know. You don't.
What percentage do you think it's going to be? You think it's going to be 5%, 10%?
That are local businesses?
Yeah, locally owned businesses, entrepreneurs. You're talking about people can make it in this country. Who are the entrepreneurs?
I'll say in the local malls, and depending on which mall you go to, because here in Portland, there's several. I'll say it's probably 30%.
Okay. How old are you, Baum?
43.
Okay, so you were a little kid when Reagan, you were 10 years old when Reagan basically, or 13 years old when Reagan came into office, or 10 or 11. Do you remember the time? I mean, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 82. Do you remember the time when you could walk into a local mall and every store was locally owned?
Actually, I remember like some strip malls and things when I was a kid, but let me ask you this.
So where have they gone?
I'm sure they've been eaten up by corporations.
So
they've merged with other businesses. They've gone out of business.
And the rich got richer, and the small business people got screwed.
Or sold. But let me ask you this. Do you not think that it has anything at all to do with parenting and priorities?
No.
Because I know that when you
No, I think it has to do with Ronald Reagan not enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and dropping the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. Period.
So how on earth, if
you lost your job, how long, and you couldn't find another one, how long would it be before you were out of money?
I'm self-employed.
Okay, so if your business went broke, how long would it be?
My business went broke in 2007 when everything crashed, and I rebuilt myself in the last 3 years, and now I'm back to the same level that I was back when the economy crashed.
Well, good on you for that. I'm sure you have many friends. How many people do you think have the skills to be an entrepreneur like you and I have been?
You know, I've got a lot of friends across a lot of spectrums. I don't have a lot of wealthy friends because I'm not I wouldn't say that I'm a wealthy person. I make, under $100,000 a year total for my family.
But, Bob, my point is you and I both know that managing other people, starting a business, taking risks, learning how to read a P&L and a balance sheet, those are things that don't just happen organically or naturally. And those are skill sets that a lot of people just can't acquire. And those people are never going to have those chances. And in particular, if getting sick ruins them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, Baum, I wish we could talk longer. We're out of time. Thank you for the call, though. And let's continue this conversation again some other time. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, and dare to say no? I don't think so. I genuinely don't think so. 866-987-THOM is our telephone number. And Michael in Lafayette, Louisiana. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I'm a new listener. I find your show interesting.
But?
That wasn't a knock, okay? I get my news from a lot of sources, and sure. There is truth in what you say sometimes, and I do agree with some of your positions. But to be honest, I kind of find your attitude just a tad condescending, okay? Like I said, this ain't a hate call. That's just the impression I get. And this is a serious question, Tom.
Sure.
I'd like to know when you and the other side, the other party, will stop blaming each other and get out of this two-party only thinking box, okay?
Okay.
Now, what you just said about President's speech, trickle-down economics did not work. Clearly it didn't. Mm-hmm. But, hey, guess what? what he's doing isn't working either. So let's quit saying, oh, that didn't work. And the other side's going, yeah, but his isn't working either.
Well, I'd say, you know what, he was, first of all, what he's doing actually is working. We have had 14 straight months of private sector job growth after, when he came into office, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. So, A, what he's doing is working. It isn't working well enough. It's not working fast enough. And that's because the Republicans won't let him do more of it. But that stimulus kept us from dropping off the edge into a Great Depression. That said, can you please identify any time in the history of the United States when we didn't have a two-party system?
You're right, but that's not the point.
That's absolutely the point, and that's what James Madison was freaked out about when he wrote Federalist Number 10. He supervised the writing of the Constitution in 1787, and after he was done, him and Hamilton went out, and John Jay went out to sell the thing by writing the Federalist Papers, and it suddenly hit him, holy cow, we've created this first-past-the-post, winner-take-all system where if more than, you know, if you've got two political parties, you could have democracy because you could have 51%. You could have majority rule. But if you have three political parties, then whoever has 34% of the vote could run the country. And that's not democratic, small d democratic. If you had four political parties, you could have 26%. And he freaked out. He didn't know what to do about it. And so he wrote Federalist Number 10 saying, please don't form political parties. And the consensus of the founders, and there's a great book about this. It's called The Revolution of 1800. It's out of print, but you can buy used copies of it on, you know, Amazon and every place else. But that goes back and actually, you know, what did Washington have to say about this? What did Adams have to say about this? What did Jefferson have to say about this? What did Jay and Hamilton and all the other, the consensus right across the board in the first 8 or 10 years of the Republic was, you know, political parties were a pox on democracy. They would destroy our country. We should never have them. And because you could only have two, and they couldn't figure out how to create a system where you could only have, where you could have more than two. And it wasn't until 1861 when John Stuart Mill wrote On Democracy. And at that point in time, there was only five countries in the world that had adopted a small d democratic form of government like ours. And they'd all done it like ours. And John Stuart Mill came along and he said, I've got this idea for something called proportional representation, where whatever party, if a party gets 20% of the vote, in other words, instead of having candidates run, you have parties run. And, you know, you can, the party can say, this is going to be our guy, but you have the parties run. And if a party gets 20% of the vote, they get 20% of the seats in the parliament or in the legislature. If they get 16%, they get 16% of the seat. If they get 5%, they get 5%. And that's why in France you have 9 major political parties. It's why in Germany you've got 5 major political parties. It's why in Israel you've got, you know, 7 or 8 political parties that have formed a coalition government. It's why in virtually every country in the world, except the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and Greece, those are the only countries that have first past the post, winner take all elections. You have multiple political parties and coalition governments and the ability to get out of that two-party mentality. And Australia and New Zealand got around it by coming up they have a name for it in Australia, but basically what it is a form of voting where where you vote for, they call it ranked voting in Australia, where you say, okay, this is, you know, Al Gore would be my first choice, instant runoff voting is what we call it here in the United States. And you would say, for example, you know, I'll vote for Ralph Nader as my first choice, but my second choice is Al Gore. And so if the first choice doesn't make it in the first cut, then your second choice becomes your vote. And that's what they do in Australia. That's what they do in New Zealand. And they're working with variations on that in several other countries. But the rest of the world has proportional representation. And so they're not stuck in this two-party paradigm. We are stuck in it. And we can't get out of it. And so here we are. We got to do something about it. What do you think we should do?
And you know what, Tom? Here's my problem with it. Because as it's worked out in reality, what we've had for the last few decades is the two parties doing nothing but blaming each other. And look, both parties have had it every way, you know, Democratic president, Democratic majority, Republican, you know, and every you know, possibility in between, and it's always the same.
No, it's not. We have not had a serious Democratic.
You're spending way too much, and you got to agree with me on that.
No, I don't.
Too much salary, too much perks for these congressional people.
I do not.
Be honest. Too much, man. Too much.
I do not.
Nothing gets done.
Michael,
why should they get
Michael, let's take these things one at a time.
Blame each other.
Let's take these things one at a time. First of all, you think, you know, members of Congress have too many perks. You know, we could debate that. The fact of the matter is they have access basically to the same health care system that all federal employees have. It's a good and generous system. I think everybody should have, access to that at the
I'm
very
not
least.
Speaking
and that's
of
what Obamacare will. Okay, so they're making $180,000 a year. If you were to cut back the salaries of members of Congress and you're going to say to somebody, okay, we're going to give you a job where you have no job security. You may be out of work in 2 years and you're going to have to maintain residences in two different places, in Washington, D.C., one of the most expensive cities in the world, and your home district. And we're only going to pay you $40,000 a year. Do you know who we'd have as all of our legislators? Millionaires. Do you really want a democracy where all of our representatives are people who are independently wealthy?
But I wasn't speaking of their salaries either.
What are you talking about?
I'm speaking about things like all they have to do is get elected once, and then they get an unbelievable pension for the rest of their life.
That's not true. That's not true.
You have
no. It is not true. I strongly suggest you go to Snopes. You have been getting these right-wing emails that are going around that have all these, you know, so-and-so is going to get millions of dollars when he retires. They're simply not true. I'm telling you, it's not true. The pensions that federal employees get. The legislators get the same pensions that other federal employees get. I'm not here to defend these guys. I'm very horrified by the status quo. But that's not the problem. The problem isn't attacking the legislators. The problem is that the Supreme Court has said that corporations are people and money is speech. So you've got some cranky billionaires like the Koch brothers funding things like ALEC and the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute who are coming in.
I agree with you. I disagree with that decision by the court, definitely.
Okay.
So,
I see that as the cancer at the core of the whole thing. And we do have term limits in the United States. They're called elections. We need to get more people involved in those elections.
You hit the nail right on the head, Tom.
Okay. So the big challenge, Michael, that we've got is how do we figure out how to get more people involved in elections? You know, in Australia, if you don't vote, you get the equivalent of a traffic ticket the first time. It's $25 fine, as I recall. Second time, it's like $100 fine. Third time, and it starts going up really fast and really radically. 98% of people in Australia vote. And we got to figure out, now I don't think we could do that here. I think it violates our constitution. But we've got to figure out a way to get people engaged in our politics so that we will have effective term limits. And the way to do that is not what the Republicans are doing, where they're passing these laws that are going to knock 5 million people at least off the voting rolls in the 2012 election. We need more people voting, not fewer.
People are dying all over the world just to vote. We really should be ashamed of ourselves when we look at all
the
voters.
I am absolutely with you, Michael. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you very much for the call and for raising good and important points. Ricardo in Casa Grande, Arizona. Hey, Ricardo, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Just a brief comment about corporations being human entities.
Yes.
If that, assuming that is the case, why should those individuals not be bound by the death penalty when they get caught in their murderous activities? Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Ricardo. And his question, if you had a hard time understanding it because the phone was pretty broken up, the cell phone, is if corporations are persons, why aren't they held to the death penalty? Well, I'm an opponent of the death penalty, but not for corporations because nobody dies. I think, you know, we used to have the corporate death penalty in the United States, and corporations routinely got it. As late as the 1870s, on average, 2,000 corporations a year in America got the corporate death penalty, where secretaries of state would go in and say, this corporation is not behaving in the public interest, and therefore we are going to take all of their assets and sell them at auction, and we're going to take the money from the sale of those assets and distribute it first to all of the creditors to the corporation, and then if there's any money left over, the rest of it goes to the stockholders. And then the stockholders can take that money and they can start a new corporation if they want, but this one is gone. It has been hung. It has been put in front of the firing squad. It's gone to the gas chamber. It is time to have the corporate death penalty in the United States. I am absolutely with you. And when we have corporations like Massey, you know, the Massey Mine Company that then was sold to, you know, whatever this company was that yesterday said, oh yeah, well, you know, 29 guys dead. Okay. We'll pay $200 million fine. Write it off our taxes or, you know, call it a cost of business or what? You think the CEO is going to take a cut in his $1 million paycheck? Somehow I doubt it. This is wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm a little worked up. I need somebody to talk me down here. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes and find out what's going on in the world.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And speaking of Talk Radio News, Victoria Jones is with us. Hey, Victoria. It looks like you are in the White House.
I am indeed in the White House.
Deep in the basement, underneath the where the president sits.
Underneath where the president sits.
So what's
yes,
up?
Indeed. Breaking news from Illinois. Former Governor Rod Blagojevich sentenced just now to 14 years in prison, convicted of corruption, as you know.
Wow, 14 years. That's a good one.
That is a good one, yes. The judge gave him a 20-minute-plus lecture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just trickling out now, so I just have snippets. One of the big things that was said yesterday at the sentencing by the defense was that he's such a wonderful father and how much his daughters would miss him and, you know, and how tragic this would be. And the judge said, well, some of these thoughts should have stopped you back then, as tragic as this is, that
right.
It should have stopped you. He said that you never asked for a lawyer, and you didn't ask for a lawyer because you didn't want to know. And that you were ill-suited for public office.
Did Blago defend himself in this trial?
No, he had lawyers.
Okay. So, he didn't ask for a lawyer back when he was committing the crimes.
When he was committing the crimes.
He didn't ask for legal advice because he didn't want somebody to tell him that it was illegal what
exactly.
he was doing.
Exactly. He said, you didn't want to know. He said, you're ill-suited for public service.
Right.
He said, I accept your guilty plea. He said it came late. He said, basically the job swap, the jury didn't believe you on the stand, and neither did I. yeah, exactly.
The ultimate reality show just came to an end.
I know. Blagojevich says that he never set out to break the law or cross a line.
Right. Bernie Madoff said the same thing, I think.
Yeah. He has until February the 16th to spend time with his family, and then he will turn himself into prison. Maybe he could become roomies with former Governor George Ryan, his predecessor, who
right.
is serving time.
Yeah. Now, you know, 14-year sentence, that means he'll probably be in jail, what, 6 years, 8 years?
I don't know how their sentencing guidelines work in Illinois. I don't
yeah.
know what their issues are. But, I mean, he will serve some real time.
Yeah.
What kind of prison he's in, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe some toilet scrubbing, something like that. Maybe some time in the library. I don't know what he'll be doing.
The kind of jobs that Newt Gingrich thinks the school children in poor cities should do.
Exactly.
Okay.
Public service.
There you go.
Exactly.
All right, so what else is going on?
Quite a lot is going on. Very interesting development today. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, today rejected a request to let young teenage girls buy the controversial morning-after pill Plan B directly off drugstore and supermarket shelves without a prescription.
Now, right now, if you're over 17, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe, though, if you're over 17, you don't need a doctor's prescription, but you do have to ask a pharmacist to hand you the pills. Is that right?
That's right. That's
okay.
right.
And so what this would have done is it would have said you don't have to show that you're over 17 and you don't have to talk to the pharmacist. You can, you know, they're just hanging there on the rack next to the condoms, probably
and
in that
the
department.
Sponges. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And the Health and Human Service Department said it's absolutely fine. And in fact, they said we've done studies, in fact, on young girls to see whether they can follow the directions. And our studies have shown, one study involving 300 girls aged 11 to 16 showed they could use the product properly and safely. And they had another study, 12 to 17, and 72 to 96% of them understood the proposed package label well enough to use the drug safely and effectively on their own.
Right.
So you've got a split between the Health and Human Services Department and the FDA on this
issue.
Well,
let's admit, I'll stipulate, you can push back on this or not, that this decision was made based more on politics than on science, because if the Obama administration made the morning after pill, which is arguably an abortifacient, I mean, you know, the real fundamentalist right-to-lifers consider this an abortion pill. And if that pill was made available over the counter, then they would, you know, they would go nuts. They will go nuts. I mean, just the fact that it was being considered was all over Drudge yesterday. They were going nuts.
Absolutely.
And so I think this was, you know, they may change their mind after the 2012 election. They may revisit this topic. But right now, they probably made the right political decision not to create a firestorm.
I think this was a political decision also. There was no medical reason, apparently, to do this. I mean, conservatives are saying, you know, this would have made young girls prey to men who would force them to take it. But, of course, men could force girls to use condoms to have sex with them.
Well,
you could make
that
the
matter,
argument to have condoms off the shelf.
Yeah, or for that matter, if a man is over 17, he can go in and buy them himself and then force a girl to take them.
Exactly, exactly. So the argument doesn't really stand. But, yeah, certainly I think that this was a political decision, yes.
Okay. What else?
Also today, prosecutors have called off their 30-year battle to put former Black Panther Mumia Abdul-Jabbar to death in the killing of a white police officer.
Well, that's interesting. What state is this?
This is in Pennsylvania.
This is a federal no, there's no federal death penalty. So, or yes, there is, actually.
Yes,
Tim McVeigh got it.
Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. This is putting an end to the racially charged case that became a major battleground in the fight over the death penalty.
Right, so this is a federal case, a federal death penalty case.
Yeah, Mumia Abdul-Jabbar, whose case has been taken up by celebrities, by journalists,
sure.
Became a worldwide phenomenon. The reason it's being announced now is because the Supreme Court declined to weigh in on the case in October, so that forced prosecutors to decide if they wanted to again pursue the death penalty through a new sentencing hearing or accept a life sentence, and they decided to do that.
Right, so he just gets a life sentence. So that's good news. I mean, I think, you know, as an opponent of the death penalty, I would say that's good news.
And meanwhile, Representative Charlie Rangel today has renewed his call for a mandatory military draft.
Yeah, he's been on this program calling for that. I agree with him on it.
Yeah, he did it today on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Perfect day, perfect timing. I had forgotten today was the anniversary. In fact, we were going to play a clip from that. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Stick around. Stephen Moore coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we build an economy and a country that works for all, that respects the classic American values of caring and fairness and loyalty and sanctity and authority and liberty? Yesterday, the president called out trickle-down economics. And first, let me welcome my guest, Stephen Moore. Is an economist and an editorial board member and senior economics writer for the Wall Street Journal. And Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Yesterday, the president called out trickle-down economics and by name, and something or Reaganomics, or by various names that I think you consider yourself one of the fathers or godfathers of. Here's what he had to say. This is just a very, very short clip, a 14-second clip. Here's a piece of what he had to say about it.
It didn't work when it was tried in the decade before the Great Depression. It's not what led to the incredible post-war booms of the 50s and 60s. And it didn't work when we tried it during the last decade.
So since 1980, the income for the top one-tenth of 1% has gone up, since Reagan came into office, has gone up 400%. The income for the bottom 50% has dropped 33%. The tax rate collections on the top 1% of income were 42% in 1960. In other words, 42% of the income of the top 1% went to taxes. Today it's 17.6. Tell me that trickle-down economics isn't a disaster.
Well, thank you for calling me one of the godfathers of supply-side economics. I wrote a book on this. Look, I have a total different interpretation of these numbers. I think if you look at the three of the biggest boom periods of the last century, it was clearly the 1920s, the 1960s, and the 1980s. Kennedy, who President Obama talked about, was a supply-sider. He was the one, remember, Tom, who proposed a 30% across-the-board tax rate reduction, which was enacted after his death. Those were
actually, if I may correct you, Stephen, because I have to, every time a conservative comes on and quotes Jack Kennedy, I just have to point out that's not what Jack Kennedy said. Jack Kennedy in that debate with Richard Nixon, and this was, and he was consistent in saying this, and I defy you to find any clips or any legislation that says the opposite, said that he wanted to see tax changes that would result in increased revenue.
Right.
He was in that class that was in the 91% tax bracket, and nobody he knew was paying that, and he
wanted
to close the loopholes, reduce that level down to 74%, but he didn't think that more tax was going to come in because he was lowering taxes. He was actually raising taxes on the rich, and he went on to talk about how he would spend that extra money.
You and I totally agree. What Kennedy said is, I remember the exact quote from his speech in the New York Economics Club a few months before he was assassinated. He said, "It is a paradoxical truth that tax rates are too high in America today and tax revenues are too low. And the best way to increase the tax revenues is to cut the rates now." That was true in the 1960s. It proved to be true. It was true when Reagan.
Okay. Speaking of quote, here is his quote.
We're not going to get any more revenues by trying to raise taxes.
No,
on the rich.
Here is his quote. Here's Kennedy in his own words, right here.
Yes, I have stated in both debates, and state again, that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we have in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
And then he says,
third, I think it's possible to gain $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
And then he talks about how he's going to spend that money, that $1 billion.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
He wanted to balance the budget by raising tax revenue.
But if you look at what he did, there's no question. He cut the top income tax rate from 91%
by closing the loopholes. As I pointed out, you have the top.
I'm in favor of that.
You want to go back to when the top 1% were paying 42% of their income in taxes.
In 1986, we did exactly that under Reagan. We got rid of all the loopholes, not all of them, but a lot of the loopholes in the tax code, and we cut the top tax rate to 28%. And by the way, that passed like 97-3 in the United States Senate.
I know. A lot of people were drinking
that
Kool-Aid. And the consequence of that was that you tripled the national debt.
But, Tom, tax reform.
That is not what Kennedy was talking about.
All my liberal friends like you, Tom, say, we got to reform the tax system. I am all in favor of it. Tax reform means lowering the tax rates and getting rid of the loopholes, not raising the tax rates. That only makes tax loopholes all the more valuable.
You know, Stephen, if our tax rate right now is 91%, as it was when Jack Kennedy said those words, I would agree with you. Let's take it down to 74%. But the top tax rate right now that is paid by capitalists, the capitalist gains tax, which 50% of all the capitalist gains taxes, income taxes paid in the United States are paid by the top 1/10 of 1% of Americans. And that top tax rate, the top tax rate, is 15% right now, as you well know.
What you're missing is that is all the money that gets invested in the economy.
No, it's not.
I don't understand.
That's the money that those people use to put in their Swiss bank accounts.
No, it's not. They don't put it in Swiss. Some of them do, and if that's the case, it should be taxed. But I'm talking about if you want to suffocate businesses, you're going to raise the capital gains and dividend tax. That's going to be less.
So you're saying that Ronald Reagan, who proposed,
you get less of it.
Stephen, in 86, Reagan proposed that the capital gains tax, the capitalist gains tax, should be identical to the wage income yeah. tax, the same way it was. You realize the first president who carved out a separate and lower tax rate for capitalists was Harding in 1921. Prior to that, the two tax rates were the same. And Reagan said they should be the same and made them the same for 1 year in 1986. Are you suggesting we go back to that we raise that capitalist gains tax from 15% up to the 35% of the regular wage
income? The deal was we raised the capital gains tax, which I think was a mistake, in exchange for lower rates on personal income. If we could get the top tax rate down to 25% or so, yeah.
If it was a mistake, why was Reagan in favor of it?
Because here's the thing that you miss about this, Tom. The capital gains tax is a double tax, just like the dividend tax. The dividend tax.
All taxes are double tax, Stephen.
The corporate income is already taxed at the corporate level. Then you tax it when it's passed on to the shareholder.
Do you think that the paycheck that my employees get is coming, that money has not been taxed before they get it?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, there's so many
corporations pay taxes. I mean, there's no such thing as, this double taxation thing is a canard, and it.
But Tom, you know this too. The corporations can deduct their payroll, so they're not paying a double tax. The corporations can't deduct their dividend payments.
No, and it's a fine thing that.
But they do deduct their wages and salaries we pay, so it's not a fair comparison.
Well,
my only point is, look, I think you and I, Tom, we care about the middle class. We care about growing this economy. We care about growing jobs. And what I disagree with about the president and your model is somehow that by raising taxes on the people who do the investing, who start the businesses, who are the ones who are the risk takers, that somehow that's going to make our economy healthier.
But their labor is more valuable than the people who are actually doing the work.
I think they're both valuable. And
what could anybody do that could possibly justify a salary of $1 million a day?
If you're talking about somebody like Fred Smith, who owns and operates a company that has hundreds of thousands of workers,
yeah.
I don't have a problem with paying that guy $1 million or $10 million or $100 million. But you know
what? But a person who is saving people's lives,
Congress, $150,000, they didn't do squat.
But a physician, a person who's saving people's lives, they shouldn't make $100 million.
I don't know if they should or shouldn't, but I don't think you should make that decision or me. That should be made by the free market system.
Okay. Well, now we've started a whole new argument about what's a free market, which we'll have to save for another time. Stephen Moore, it's always interesting and enjoyable talking with you. Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Topics.wsj.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we create an economy that works for all? And did the president hit it out of the park yesterday? And is he going to follow through with legislation? Trust 20 minutes past the hour, 25 million unemployed or underemployed, 16% of the American population. The top six banks own $9 trillion in assets. That represents 65% of the GDP of the United States. The top 1% earns more than the bottom 50%. The top 0.1% gets half of all the capitalist gains in the United States. The Commerce Department says that wages are the lowest share of GDP since 1929, and the corporate profits are the highest since 1929. And we all know what happened in 1929. We got 53 million Americans without health insurance, 44 million Americans on food stamps, nearly half of them children, 49 million Americans living in poverty, one in five of them children. Only 58% of eligible Americans eligible to work have a job. The median yearly wage is only $26,261 a year. Tell me we are not in trouble. The average household debt in the United States, $75,600 a year. American families are $7.7 trillion poorer than they were in 2007, thanks to the great Bush crash. We have serious problems that we need to address. Chris in San Luis Obispo, California, says, you disagree. Boy, people are calling and saying, I disagree. I hope it's not just to get to be first in line, because that's what always happens. Chris, what do you disagree with me about?
I've been on hold for almost an hour and a half. I hope that's not.
Yeah, you and a lot of other people. My apologies for that, but that's just, that's radio.
Thanks for putting me on anyway.
Sure, what's up?
I disagree with you. A couple of weeks ago, you said that we've been under a libertarian economic system, and I do. I totally disagree with that. And
I disagree with that too.
You disagree that I disagree?
No, you're right. That was hyperbole. We are not. Okay. We are not in a libertarian economic system. We have been moving closer and closer ever since Ronald Reagan came into office two libertarian-like policies, but no way are we where Ron Paul wants us to be. No way.
No. So and there's, I mean, libertarians have been marginalized and have been arguing against our economic system for decades. So,
yes.
I'm a layperson, you know, in the economics field, but I learned a lot through reading about economics, and I think what you said, you're against the gold standard, and I would want to try to explain briefly why the gold standard is so vital, and why we've had, ever since the Federal Reserve was created, these boom and bust cycles. And
well, no, we have, from the founding of this republic in 1789 until 1935, we never went more than 15 years, typically 12. 12 was the average, but we never went more than 15 years in the entire history of the republic, from the George Washington administration to the Franklin Roosevelt administration, without a major crash and bank panic. And then they put into place Glass-Steagall and the FDIC, and we went 60 years without one.
No, we
and it had nothing to do with the gold standard.
We've had huge booms and busts, even
not major panics. I'm talking about where half the banks in the country fail, where the stock market drops precipitously. I mean, you had the
we should be allowing them to fail, but is a libertarian point of view. But the gold standard.
I don't disagree with you on that. But here's my question about the gold standard. I'm not opposed to the gold standard. I'm ambivalent about it. I can make arguments on either side, and here's the argument against it that I would love to hear somebody refute. The gold standard says that if you have a trillion-dollar economy and you got $1 trillion in currency floating around in the economy, then you have to have $1 trillion worth of gold. Are we on the same page so far?
It does not. The classical gold standard does allow for inflation, but it's controlled. And the way the gold standard works is by equaling out economies over time. What happens when a country is poor? Their prices are low and their wages are low, and when they, which allows them to move their products over their borders and sell them to stronger.
Well, no. Let's get back to the gold standard here. If the gold standard doesn't mean that the value of your currency is fixed by the amount of gold that you have, but instead it means that the value of your currency can be manipulated or changed regardless of the price of gold or the amount of gold that you have, then what good is the gold standard? You can inflate your currency with or without the gold standard.
The gold standard limits the amount you can inflate. And
well, why not just limit that by law? I mean, if you're going to set up a set of rules we're on the gold standard and we're going to limit the amount of inflation, well, what you're doing is you're giving to your legislature the power to regulate the value of your currency, which, by the way, is what the Constitution does.
Well, what the gold standard does is, like I was saying, when you're a poor country, you have cheaper wages and cheaper prices, so you're able to export. And then
That has to do with the cost of living.
No, it has to do with the gold standard. That's why I'm trying to explain how the gold standard works, in order so that we can understand why the centrally planned economies create these huge booms and huge busts. And the 50s were a boom. The Reagan era was a boom, and they're all centrally planned booms and busts. But
Reagan was a boom because he tripled our national debt. I mean, you give me $3 trillion on a credit card, I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
He also inherited over 10% unemployment, so it was
He did not inherit. When Reagan came into office, the unemployment rate was just under 7%, and by 1982, when he had his major tax cut in place, it went up to 11%. That was Reagan's doing. Go back and look at the numbers.
Well, can I get back to the gold standard and how it works? Okay, so what you have is when you're a poor country, you don't have much gold. Your wages are low, your prices are low. As you export and become wealthier, your wages and your prices go up. That tips the balance back to where the poorer countries that have lower wages and lower prices start to regain their ability to export goods. And it creates a growth and recession period, which is limited. And what we've had since we had the Federal Reserve is centrally planned economies where we create
Chris, what you're describing is what David Ricardo wrote about in 1819 in On Wages and On Labor. And it has nothing to do with gold. It's the natural, that's the natural flow of economies. You know, as there's more wealth, you know, of course, wages go up and standards of living go up. But, Chris, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We'll have to carry this conversation on another time.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Still don't get it. But, you know, maybe one of these days. I'll figure it out. 27 minutes past the hour. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very unisonously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. I'm going to go drink some now so I can understand the gold standard better. The good. U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg. After a tumultuous weekend between Occupy D.C. and the police, the movement scored a small victory this week. In a ruling issued on Monday night, Judge Boasberg protected Occupy D.C. from any Bloomberg-style midnight raids by police on the encampment. Boasberg said that the National Guard Service must give Occupy D.C. at least a 24-hour notice before carrying out any sort of eviction. The judge went on to say, absent such notice, the government will not restrict plaintiff's access to the square or his camping or sleeping in the square. Good move. The bad. Dick Morris. The toe sucker was on GOP TV's Fox and Friends this morning and confirmed all of our suspicions about the role Fox so-called news plays in picking the next Republican presidential nominee. While sitting on the couch with Ducey, Kilmeade, and Carlson, longingly looking at their toes, Morris said this about Gingrich's recent surge in the polls in Iowa.
You don't win Iowa in Iowa. You win it on this couch. You win it on Fox News.
And give me that foot. Excuse me. And excited, Ducey responded, that could make this the most powerful piece of furniture in America. That's right. It doesn't matter what voters want. It matters what billionaire Rupert Murdoch wants. Does anyone still doubt that the Republican primary is really the Murdoch primary? And the very, very ugly Rick Perry. With Governor Goodhair's campaign now completely derailed, Perry cut a new political ad in Iowa trying to remake himself as the ultimate culture warrior. In the ad, as he's strolling through a green meadow in a barn coat, Perry says, I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm a Christian, but you don't need to be in the pew every Sunday to know that there's something wrong in this country when gays can serve openly in the military, but our kids can't openly celebrate Christmas or pray in school. End of quote. All right. That's what's really wrong with our country. Gays in the military and the war on Christmas. And for the record, kids can openly pray in school. There's nothing, no law against it. Maybe the guy who's executed more people than any other governor in America in modern history shouldn't be touting his moral convictions and all the hours he spends in church, because that's very, very ugly, particularly when he doesn't even have his facts right. I mean, that's the thing that, you know, just makes me crazy. He doesn't even have his facts right. So, anyway, okay, we got calls here from North Carolina, Indiana, Arizona, Illinois, Utah, Massachusetts, and it says disagree in Tampa, Florida. Stephen. You disagree with me. You're at the top of the list. What's up?
You were going on. You were talking about how it's important to vote and all that.
Yes, I believe it is.
Pardon?
I believe it is.
Yeah. Well, I felt that way. You know, I'm 34 now, you know, since I could vote. Even before that, my grandfather instilled in me the importance. And one of your callers had talked about how people are dying all over the world just with the chance to vote.
Yes.
And I agree that it's important to vote. It's unfortunate that I'm feeling more and more like some Republicans would, and I'm not very, very far from a Republican, about how I'm losing faith in a federal government. The reason is when you debated the gentleman you had on before, I think his name is Mark, and you had, or whenever you debate someone or whenever I debate with my conservative friends, you know, we bring up how, Reagan was terrible because of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And we bring up how Bush was, you know, bad because blah, blah, blah. And I really don't think that it's important for me to vote for Obama this next time. And the reason is that already my conservative friends are saying, well, you know, you've got 4 years now. where 2 years of it, you had the supermajority and you did nothing.
They didn't have a supermajority.
Well, you had a majority in the House and the Senate, and you were able to pretty much
No, they didn't. First of all, Joe Lieberman was not a Democrat. He's an independent. Bernie Sanders is an independent. The Democrats never had they had 58 votes or maybe 59. But arguably, Ben Nelson is not a Democrat. You know, Mary Landrieu is only a Democrat sometimes. Blanche Lincoln was, you know, a Democrat 10% of the time. I would submit to you that the last time that there was a genuine Democratic majority in the House, the Senate, and the White House was in the 1930s during the Roosevelt administration. And the last time there was a genuine Republican majority was during the 1980s during the Reagan Revolution. And both of those times you saw major shifts in this country, and pretty much the rest of the time what you see is us kind of muddling through. And let me just share with you real quickly, and then I'll give you all the time you want. This is Paul Weyrich. This was Ronald Reagan's chief strategist in 1980, and he also was a chief strategist for the Bush senior campaign and the Bush junior campaign. He died last year. But this was Paul Weyrich speaking to a group of conservative Christian Republican partisans, activists, who were about to go out into the field back in 1980. And he's talking about the Reagan campaign. And this is why during that campaign and during times before that, people like Rehnquist would stand in line in African-American districts. Rehnquist down in Arizona did it in Native American communities and Hispanic communities. And they would challenge voters if their driver's license, for example, said Patrick Rodriguez, but it said Pat Rodriguez on their voter registration card or something like that. They would forbid them from voting if there was any slight discrepancy, but only in those areas. Here's why. This is what Paul Weyrich had to say to his Republican friends.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So there you go. And what they want, what negative advertising does, is it does not increase votes for the candidate that is running the negative ads against the other person. It reduces the number of people who vote, period. What it does is it causes people to say, to hell with it, they're all crooks. And that's why the Republicans, are, in particular, although there are some Democrats who do it as well, are so into negative advertising. And I would say despair is not an option. You need we all must be participating, not just voting, participating. Your turn.
I guess then you're like telling me that I'm supposed to hold my nose and vote for Obama again.
No, I'm not.
I don't agree.
I'm not. I am not being partisan here. I'm not a Democrat.
No,
I'm not here
that,
to defend the Democratic Party or Barack Obama.
No, I realize that. But, I mean, I'm a progressive, so, of course, I'd have to vote towards progressives. However, I'm sorry. I thought I got cut off. However, because I'm a progressive, I mean, where am I going to go? You know, I agree wholeheartedly with Ron Paul's foreign policy, but I'm terrified to death over his policy here in the United States. I mean, so what am I supposed to do? You know, and how am I going, you know, warrantless wires have still happened. I mean, we only have we have one Bernie Sanders. We have one Elizabeth Warren. We have one Kucinich.
Yeah.
You know,
you have about 80 of them. You know, the Progressive Caucus has between 80 and 90 members.
Yeah, but where are they? I mean, they haven't done
they're speaking
anything.
Out very loudly. I mean, you know, it's just that the media, by and large, doesn't cover them. I mean, Jan Schakowsky's been on this program a few times, but, you know, who was the one person who refused to vote, for example, for the war
out.
In Iraq? It was Barbara Lee.
I'm not talking about talking or speaking out against things. I'm talking about actually doing something and getting up and walking out or doing something. You know, how many times I watched like 4 or 5 hours worth of C-SPAN a day. I'm watching and nobody's sitting
Stephen,
in there.
Stephen, what I'm hearing from you, respectfully, what I'm hearing from you, if I may, what I'm hearing from you is a guy saying, I think that the beginning and end of my civic responsibility is to vote. And because I don't have good people to vote for, or they're not good enough, or there's not enough good people to vote for, I'm feeling like to hell with it. And
absolutely
I would
not.
Respectfully say to you, that is not your civic, the beginning and end
no,
of your
I
civic
agree.
Duty.
We agree on that.
It's the least
I,
of your civic duties.
Absolutely. I see you're wrong. I agree with you on that. As a matter of fact, I went to, I live actually in Gainesville. I went to the Occupy thing for 2 weeks until I strongly disagree with a large portion of what's happening. And so, you know, I'm out there holding signs, you know, whenever we were
going through George W. Bush, I live in Florida. You know how many days I stood on a picket line saying, look, count my vote.
Great.
You know, I mean, I'm out there with my, you know, with other people. And we're here, but it's our representatives that I have a problem with and who is put there to vote.
Stephen, we all feel this. We all feel that way. We all feel that way. And it's never going to be perfect. But I'm telling you, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony in 1787 sat down in their living room together and conspired for Susan B. Anthony in the election of 1888 rather, to vote and get arrested, as I recall, it was 1884. It was around that time, to vote and get arrested. And she did. She voted and got arrested. They did not know if in their lifetime they would ever see women vote, and they didn't. They both died before it happened. And that doesn't mean that you don't do it.
Right. I mean, look, I know I've seen jaded. I mean, I'm only 34 years old, and I feel this way. But
you have a long time ahead of you, man.
I know.
You have a long time ahead of you.
I'll let you get to other people, but before I do, I want to let you one thing. Have you seen Brewster's Millions?
No, I haven't.
With Richard Pryor? Oh, man, you're missing out. Anyway, you should Google Vote for No One because he does this great – yeah, you should definitely – and play
but
it
see,
on your show. Because
that's what Paul Wawrick wants you to be thinking is Vote for No One.
Yeah, but that's – look, the Democrats, my progressives, my party, my people, right? I know that you're not saying one way or the other, but my people, the progressives who are supposed to stand for what I believe in, that I'm paying my tax dollars to represent me and my country, aren't doing anything.
Many of them are. I mean, you live in Florida. You've got Alan Grayson is going to be running. He's not in your district. He's over in Orlando. But, you know, there's somebody that you could get behind. You could do something to help out. You know, go to congressmanwithguts.com or whatever his website is. I'm pretty sure that's it. Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org. I mean, there are a lot of good people that we can help out. We need more of those voices. But most importantly, we need movement politics.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that means showing up, which you said you're doing. I mean, I honor you for that. If you're showing up at the Occupy movements, that is great. More of it.
From the war against disorder.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Joe in Springville, Utah. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, I'd like to throw something by you. I'm a over-the-road truck driver. I'm a Vietnam vet, a Veterans for Peace member, and a veteran for the 99. And I've been going to different Occupy sites, Atlanta, Los Angeles. We have a presence there through an organization that we started promoting the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And what comes up for me is I'm very excited about Barack Obama's speech, and it's very much in line with what you've talked about. He's trying to get ahead of the parade, and it's very cool.
Yep.
And parade is the Occupy movement, and I think of the Occupy movement, and when I talk out here in the industry, I tell people the Occupy movement is the epicenter of America.
Yep.
This is where America resides, and we are outside of it. And we need to be joining with that in our own conversation. And then as this and basically, I think of it as the Declaration of Independence in action.
Yes.
And so the next step is to re-envision America. And I'm not about jobs. I'm about a way of life. I grew up on small farms in New England, and it was a way of life and restoring the grandmas and grandpas and 30 million small family farms.
Yep.
And then in the process, then I tell people, but in order to accomplish this, you got to change the policies that stand in the way of this
right.
issue.
For example, if you want to bring back those small family farms, you have to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up ConAgra and ADM and the big corporations that in the 1980s after Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act wiped out family farms across America to the point that you had Willie Nelson out there doing Farm Aid.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is to do that, you got to change the policymakers, and to change the policymakers, the people must change and adopt the Constitution as a way of life for themselves, because then there's no more Vietnam, there's no more Korea. All of a sudden we're going, oh, yeah, the Constitution says the Congress shall declare war.
Yes.
Great. So I see it as a three-step thing. The Occupy movement, and it's growing, it's in all kinds of arenas. I mean, it's doing so much neat stuff. And we need to embrace it, and we need to reprimand the parents for allowing their children to be pepper sprayed at UC Davis and things like that, and just forget the circus. it's like razzle-dazzle crap. It's like, yeah. It doesn't matter.
You know what the Occupy movement is doing, Joe, is it is demonstrating that there is, at the core of America, in the deep body of America, you know, at the heart of America, in the viscera, in the guts of America, there is this notion of a way of life, of an idea that, you know, I mean my dad, worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, and because he worked in a good union shop and had a good union wage and had, you know, full health benefits and a full pension, he was able to have his house paid off when he retired. He was able to have health benefits until the day he died. And then, in fact, they rolled over until the day my mother died about 5 years later. And he was able to raise four boys. It was a three bedroom house, you know, five, six people living in it. But, he was able to raise four boys and put some of us through school. And it was like this was the American dream. My dad lived the American dream. The American dream has been ripped out of the hands of my children. And
the American dream for me was growing up on small farms because I was always in the way. Finally, one farmer put me to work because I love farming.
Yeah.
And that's what I would have done if it hadn't been for friggin' Vietnam, and all that crap. And so now I'm trying to get home again.
Yeah.
Ever since, and home in the sense of the heart, you know. I'm going to see my family. But, you know, I can't go home because I have to look at people that they sent me off to kill people without question. There was never a discussion about Vietnam. It was like, you got to go put on a uniform.
I know.
It's insane.
I know. And it was a bipartisan insanity. I mean, it was brought to you courtesy of Lyndon Johnson, you know, who was a Democrat and who in every other regard was probably one of the best presidents of the 20th century with the Great Society and civil rights and all these other things.
Oh, yeah.
And then he had this insane war where he, you know, he killed millions of people. And, you know, I think he probably went to his grave regretting that. I'm quite sure of that. But nonetheless, you know, Joe, I'm with you, and we need to revalue, in other words, restate the values of America as the values of that middle class, that American dream, that you can be a small entrepreneur. The caller I had, you know, an hour or so ago who was saying, hey, wait a minute, anybody can still make it in America, and I'm saying, not anymore. You know, not anymore, because the big corporations will squash you like a bug. If you start a small business, if you start a small retail shop, if you come up with a small, you know, a small invention, you come up with something that's going to, you know, work well on this kind of computer, that kind of computer, a giant computer company, they will squash you like a bug. And it's because the Sherman Act is not being enforced. It's because the rules of the game have changed since Reagan's presidency, and they've changed in a way that destroys small business. Joe, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Thank you so much. Just a minute left. Matt in Chicago. Hey, Matt, what's up? Matt? Okay, Matt's Josh and Eugene. Josh, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom, let's not make sure that the record's clear about what the Democrats could have and couldn't have done, had the power to do after Obama got elected. They might not have had 60 votes, but they allowed the Republican minority to rule by minority by filibustering. They could have changed the rules of the Senate. They could have called a nuclear option like the Republicans did when the Democrats were abusing the filibuster. Yeah. They said, quit it, or we're going to change the rules. But the Democrats...
Josh, you are right. Josh, you are right. President Obama was elected in a revolutionary moment. The election of 2008 was a revolutionary election, and the American people were voting for a revolutionary change figure like Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Roosevelt. That's what they thought that they were going to get, or for that matter, Ronald Reagan, somebody who was going to fundamentally change the system, which is what President Obama promised, and he didn't deliver on it. And that's why you had the Tea Party, and that's why you have the Occupy movement. And frankly, I think he is starting to get it, although, you know, who knows, but his rhetoric indicates he's starting to get it. And this next election is either going to be a revolutionary election. It is going to be about change. We are either going to take this country back, or we're going to see ourselves going down the road that Greece and Italy are going down right now, where their prime ministers are no longer elected officials. They're appointed by banksters. They are banksters appointed by banksters. Do you think that the Greeks and Italians woke, you know, ever in their lifetimes, thought that their country would be run by appointed banksters? Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.